Chapter 18. Who Killed Epstein? Immediately after his arrest on July the 6th, 2019, at New York's Teterboro Airport, Epstein was taken to the Metropolitan Correctional Facility, MCC, where he was incarcerated in a section known as 9 South, or The Hole, an extra-high security zone for violent criminals or those requiring protection, such as paedophiles and sex offenders. His cellmate was Nicholas Tartaglione, a retired police officer who had killed 4 men over unpaid drug money. Tartaglione looked like the Hulk and probably could have killed 4 men with his bare hands. Prosecutors were seeking the death sentence for his crimes at the time Epstein moved in with him, so it's hard to think of anyone more intimidating as a cellmate. Which was perhaps an intentional move on the part of the guards. Initially, other inmates and Tartaglione's lawyers claimed that he and Epstein were friends. Perhaps Epstein was buying off Tartaglione, like he had so many before, with promises of money and legal help. We know Epstein was playing the same trick with other inmates, buying commissary items such as snacks, drinks and special meals at inflated prices, which the other prisoners could use to buy their own items. One of the inmates who Epstein first got to know was William Dollar Bill Mersey, a man who had run an escort website and been imprisoned for tax fraud. According to the book The Spider Inside the Criminal Web of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell by Barry Levine, Epstein and Mersey were put together by another inmate, Michael Miles Tisdale, as part of a scheme Tisdale ran to partner new at-risk inmates with experienced companions to help them learn the ropes. According to Levine, Mersey said Epstein was worried about being attacked, specifically by black inmates, saying he'd been bullied by black kids at school. Mersey advised Epstein to look fellow prisoners in the eye and stand his ground. However, Epstein's worries grew, and according to Levine, he even considered hiring another inmate to work as his bodyguard. Another problem for Epstein was the guards, who seemed to take a dislike to him, supposedly because of the way he was throwing his money around to buy off other prisoners, and because he was using meetings with his lawyers as an excuse to get out of his cell for prolonged periods of time. According to the book, Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales, an inmate said that the guards treated Epstein worse than any other prisoner, denying him toilet rolls and essential cleaning items when he requested them. For fastidious Epstein, it must have been a nightmare. In the meantime, he had been formally charged with sex trafficking and conspiracy to traffic minors, to which he pled not guilty. He was also waiting to find out if he would be granted bail. His lawyer's case was built around the fact that Epstein had not been charged with any further crimes since his Florida sentence, thus proving that Epstein had controlled his unnatural urges. However, on July 17, something happened which blew that argument to smithereens. A case was filed by a woman identified as Caitlin Doe, who testified that Epstein had sexually abused her while on work release during his Florida prison sentence. The woman claimed that Epstein had forced her to perform sex acts on him at the office of his specially created non-profit, the Florida Science Foundation, while a deputy stood outside the door allowing the attack to happen. Following these revelations, Epstein's case crumbled, and on July 18, his request for bail was denied. 5 days later, Epstein supposedly made the first suicide attempt. On July 23 at 1:28 a.m, the guards heard someone calling for help and rushed to the cell that Epstein shared with Tartaglione. They found Epstein lying on the floor, his face, feet and hands a light blue colour. According to Epstein, Dead Men Don't Tell Tales, an inmate who witnessed the incident said the guards threw the lifeless form of Epstein face down on the floor, then again onto the stretcher, as if they thought, or expected, him to be dead. However, he was revived using CPR and taken to the infirmary where he stayed for the rest of the night. Like so much of Epstein's life, what truly happened on that night may forever be a mystery. Had he really attempted suicide? He'd certainly had a hard introduction to prison life. He was constantly in fear of being attacked or hit up to buy overpriced commissary items because of his known wealth. He was used to a life of the most rigorous cleanliness and health, not to mention good food and pampering. Whilst here he was, neglected, openly disliked, and forced to live in squalid and unsanitary conditions. By his own admission, he needed 3 orgasms a day, preferably at the hands of young girls. In New York, there was no fake work release scheme where he could continue to get his kicks. Add to all that the recent news that he wasn't getting bail, and it might just have broken him. On the other hand, the marks on his neck were slight and had practically faded by the time he reappeared in court a few days later. The injuries didn't reflect a serious suicide attempt in the guard's opinions, so perhaps he had staged the attempt to get sympathy and a cushier deal. It's certainly the kind of mind game you could imagine him playing, but he did have to be revived, so if it was a stunt, it went dangerously close to the edge. Another possibility is that Tartaglione had tried to murder him. As we've already seen, there is a code in prison to kill paedophiles on sight. However, if that was the motivation, why hadn't Tartaglione tried to kill him before? Facing the death penalty, Tartaglione might have been hired to perform the hit in exchange for a reduced sentence. 5 years after the killings, Tartaglione still has no trial date. Epstein later claimed that Tartaglione had tried to strangle him. Nearer the time of the incident, he told Tisdale that he'd been strangled but didn't name the culprit. According to Barry Levine's book, Tisdale told Levine, "All he did is make a strangling motion to himself with his hands around his neck. And I said, 'Someone else tried to strangle you,' and he gave me a little nod." However, Epstein told another inmate, Mersey, "I woke up in the middle of the night to get a glass of water, and that's the last thing I remember." This leaves open a fourth option, that someone outside of Epstein's cell, perhaps the prison staff itself, had tried to kill him. As we've already heard, it is not hard to organise a hit within a jail. However, if that was the case, why did the person not finish the job? Had they been disturbed by Tartaglione? But how would they have gotten away? Alternatively, had the guards arranged with Tartaglione himself that he would murder Epstein and they would cover it up in return for favours? This would explain their rough handling of Epstein's body, as if they expected him to remain dead. Perhaps they hadn't bargained on the staff at the infirmary actually being able to resuscitate him. Whatever the case, the implications for Epstein weren't good. He was promptly relocated to the ultra-secure suicide prevention wing, where life rapidly became more restricted. He was kept in solitary confinement with little or no luxuries, dressed in a gown made of paper, and forced to sleep in paper bedsheets so he couldn't hang himself. He was allowed no books, and at night the lights remained switched on, so he could be observed at all times. It was now that Epstein claimed that Tartaglione had tried to kill him. Either using this line or some other approach, he appears to have convinced the visiting psychologist that he was no longer a suicide threat. And, incredibly, within just 6 months of his suicide attempt, if that's what it was, Epstein was returned to his old wing. Again, there is more than one possibility here. Was it Epstein's persuasiveness alone that released him from suicide watch? or did the prison staff have a hand in it? Staff who hated Epstein and would be more than happy for him to take his own life. Whatever the case, when Epstein turned up for a hearing 2 days later on July the 31st, he appeared out of it, according to victim's attorney, Gloria Allred. The smug perma-smirk had vanished, and he remained silent and unresponsive throughout the brief hearing, in which a trial date was set for June 2020. Had Epstein given up? Apparently not. On August the 1st, he arranged a meeting with Atlanta-based lawyer David Schoen to discuss him taking over the case. Schoen said that Epstein was in good spirits and that they had agreed to meet again the following week. On August the 8th, Epstein had another meeting with his attorneys, this time to update his will. The outcome saw his fortune placed in a sealed trust that would make it much more difficult for his victims to get their hands on it. The newly formed 1953 Trust, named after the year of his birth, would protect the identities of his beneficiaries and would erect several more barriers between the survivors and his estate. As well as having to win their case in court to receive a portion of the estate as compensation, the survivors would first have to persuade a judge to release the details of the beneficiaries. The beneficiaries would also get a chance in court to argue their right to any funds that might be taken from them to pay the survivors. With all the loopholes and red tape, one expert estimated it could take as long as a decade to sort out the various conflicting claims. In retrospect, it looks like a cynical ploy from a man who knew his life was about to end, either by his own hand or because he knew he was going to be murdered. But there is another intriguing possibility behind the last-minute change to his will, which we will explore later in this chapter. Whatever the motive, the move was prescient. In just 48 hours, Epstein would be dead. Developments came thick and fast on the next day, August the 9th. Firstly, it was announced that a court had decided to unseal the documents relating to Virginia Giuffre's 2017 defamation case against Ghislaine Maxwell, revealing to the world the full scope of Epstein's operation, and dragging in names like Glenn Dubin, Bill Richardson, Murray Gell-Mann, and Alan Dershowitz. Secondly, his cellmate was removed from his cell, leaving the paedophile on his own. Was this a setup for the murder? Or perhaps a staff-assisted suicide? Or even a faked death and subsequent jailbreak? All three options remain on the table. The night of August the 9th to the 10th was the night that Epstein finally met his fate. The events surrounding it push credibility to the limits, if one believes the official story that they were all just unfortunate coincidences. The guards on duty were due to perform half-hour checks on the recently suicidal prisoner. Not one of these checks actually occurred, and it was later claimed that both guards fell asleep or were too engrossed online to perform any checks between 3:30 a.m. and 6:20 a.m. Additionally, the two cameras that constantly monitored Epstein's cell both malfunctioned on the night of his death. When combined with his early release from suicide watch and the removal of his cellmate, leaving him alone on the very evening of his death, the circumstantial evidence multiplies to make it extremely improbable that all of these incidents were mere coincidences. Then there was the autopsy, which found that he had strangled himself by tying a sheet to his bed and leaning forward in a kneeling position, even though he had broken several bones in his neck, injuries which were much more consistent with suicide involving jumping, impossible for Epstein as his bed wasn't high enough, or murder by strangulation. More on this later. There are three main explanations for Epstein's death. The first is the official story, which is that he committed suicide by self-strangulation. Evidence to back this up is the last-minute change to his will and the fact that his mental health was visibly deteriorating prior to his death. However, it doesn't explain the massive anomalies around the coincidences that surrounded his death that night. His cellmate being suddenly moved out of his cell, the cameras failing and both prison guards failing to check on him, as well as the broken bones in his neck. The suicide story becomes more plausible if we assume that guards were complicit. This would explain the security anomalies on the night of his death, but it still wouldn't account for the broken bones. Also, is it really plausible that the guards would have arranged with Epstein to allow him to commit suicide? We know they disliked him, but I'm sure they disliked a lot of prisoners. Was that motive enough to risk their jobs and even criminal charges by so obviously tampering with the security measures that evening? The second explanation is that he was murdered. Implicit in this description of events is the assumption that whoever organized the hit was powerful enough to arrange the security anomalies that occurred that evening. This would explain the guards, the cameras, and the absence of a cellmate, and also, of course, the broken bones, which were evidence of violent strangulation. If we also assume that he knew, or was at least suspicious, that a hit was out on him, it would explain the change of will and the mental deterioration of a man who knew he was going to die. The release of pictures of his cell and autopsy photos showing the marks on his neck triggered memories of when I had interviewed in Tucson prison two Tonys, a multiple homicide murderer who was an associate of the Bonanno crime family, serving 141 years. He had left the corpses of rival gangsters from Arizona to Alaska. He said that he had so many enemies, he was always ready to kill someone quickly if an assassin entered his cell. Writing his life story, I was getting the details of things he had done. So I just said to him one day, "How would you kill me right now?" In a split second, he jumped up, grabbed an electrical cord attached to a heating filament, wrapped it around my neck, and applied pressure. Detailed in my book, Prison Time. Having expected him to describe how he would kill me, I hadn't anticipated getting strangled. Although taken by surprise, I trusted him, so I didn't struggle. With my breath getting cut off, I allowed him to proceed. Eventually, I was gasping on the verge of panicking. He kept the cord tight just long enough for me to regret having asked the question. After releasing it as expertly as he'd applied it, he grinned. Speechless, I was panting and massaging my throat. But eventually I managed to smile because I had such a close relationship with him. At the request of Epstein's attorneys, New York Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Barbara Sampson's autopsy was observed by the private pathologist Dr. Michael Baden. Paid for by Epstein's brother, Baden said that the three fractures on Epstein's neck had required much more pressure than from the supposed suicide method. These fractures were more indicative of homicide, according to Baden. He added that the ligature mark on Epstein's neck didn't match the bedsheet noose seen on the photos from Epstein's cell. "It was too wide and too smooth," he said, during a Fox News interview. "This is a rougher injury." He also said there was no blood on the noose and that the three neck fractures would not have been caused by hanging. Baden continued, "I think there's a lot of information that hasn't been revealed yet that is essential in order to arrive at a conclusion whether this is a suicide or a homicide. I think the important thing is to find out what was seen when the guards first went into the cell. Was he hanging? Was he on the ground? As some people reported when he was found." He added, that the first responders destroyed a lot of the forensic evidence by removing Epstein's body too quickly. Surprise, surprise. Why would they want to provide any forensic evidence of him being killed by the deep state with a role played by the Clintons? EMS is not supposed to remove dead bodies from jails, Baden said. They're supposed to have a whole forensic workup. What kind of forensic evidence is in the clothing? How long the person was dead? We can tell from the ligature mark that he had been. There was a tight ligature around his neck for many hours and the front of his neck before he was found. So he was dead for a long time. But we could be more specific about that if somebody tested the stiffness of the body, etc., at the scene. A photo of Epstein's cell shows a combination sink toilet and double bunks, with a little ladder up to the top cell, orange bedding with breeze block walls. A close-up of his bunk shows a skinny mattress with orange bedding. The photo reveals that fragments of material were hanging from a window while a large strip of bedding was also looped through a hole on the top bunk. Another photo shows Epstein on the bunk, grey, ashen, and freshly wrapped. Another shows the broken bones in his neck, including the hyoid near his Adam's apple. On CBS, Baden repeated his allegations that it had not been a suicide. There were multiple fractures of the Adam's apple, the thyroid and the hyoid bone, that are more indicative of a homicidal strangulation than a suicidal strangulation. With hanging suicide, 90% of the time, there are no fractures. Maybe 10% or 15%, they have hyoid or thyroid fracture. You don't have three fractures with the weight of the body and the ligature. You have to have a lot more pressure by ligature or by hands to get those fractures. When two Tonys had wrapped that cord around my neck, he had done it in a friendly way. There had been enough pressure to render me unconscious and, if he had applied more, my oxygen would have been cut off and I could have died. My life could have been rapidly and efficiently ended. That brief time is all it would have taken for someone to have accessed Epstein while the two guards were conveniently asleep. An assassin could have entered his cell, done the damage and strung him up to make it look like a suicide. Lots of evidence suggests that's what happened. On 60 Minutes, Baden said, "The investigators have not said whether there was DNA on the noose. The FBI, or the medical examiner, would have done swabs for DNA on the ligature. Whose DNA is on it? Was it Epstein alone? Or Epstein and somebody else?" He added that Epstein's family believed that his death was more likely a homicide, based on the autopsy results, and that they were desperate for the truth. "There is no advantage to the family whether it is homicide or suicide. There's no money involved. They just want the truth. The brother Mark, or the estate, would just as soon have this to be a suicide because there is no advantage to them for it to be homicide." Mark Epstein is now concerned about a homicide. If his brother was killed because he knew too much, is he also in jeopardy? Are other people in jeopardy? Baden rejected the claim that he made the homicide call because he was paid by Epstein's family. He said that during his time as a medical examiner in New York in the late 1970s, his professional opinion was never swayed by who had hired him. The CBS reporter asked Baden about the position of Epstein's body, the damage to the neck, and the blood revealed for the first time in the graphic photos in the 60 Minute show. Multiple nooses fashioned from orange bedding were found. Photos showed prescription pill bottles, several electrical cords, and enough bedsheets for several inmates dumped on the floor. Note, several electrical cords. If two Tonys had been assigned to suicide Epstein, he would have gone straight for the cords. Anyone trained in the art of killing efficiently would have gone for the cords. So in all likelihood, the murder weapon was present in the cell. One possibility is that a guard performed the hit. Interviewing Ori Spado, a former mob boss, I learned more about how the mafia and the elites work together. He said that there is an overworld and an underworld. He was in the underworld, and the elites are in the overworld. He believed that the guards could have easily carried this out. Also found in Epstein's cell was a handwritten note in ballpoint pen. Epstein had been documenting the prison conditions. A guard had kept him in a locked shower stall for an hour. The note included, "Sent me for burnt food. Giant bugs crawling over my hands. No fun." High security level jails do not allow ballpoint pens. Maybe his lawyer had slipped him one. One photo from inside the cell showed multiple prescription pill bottles with Epstein's name on them and food on the top bunk. The final photo, released to 60 Minutes, was one of the noose from the bedsheets found elsewhere in his cell, which we are supposed to believe was the suicide instrument. 60 Minutes also showed a photo of the cell door with police tape on it. "Now crime scene, do not cross." There was also a photo of a barred door which separated the guards from Epstein's cell, a mere 15 feet away from them. Another photo showed the hall. Charged with falsifying records and conspiracy, the two sleepy guards pled not guilty. They were allegedly shopping online for furniture and sleeping instead of checking on Epstein. And then when they did finally check on him, they said they told their supervisor that they had messed up and hadn't done any checks in the hours before. Then they went and altered the records. Depending on your security level, there are headcounts every so many hours, and there are security walks every 20 to 30 minutes. In the MCC, they were required to walk every 30 minutes to make sure that Epstein was still alive and accounted for. A surveillance video that was made available showed the absence of security walks. However, the video showing what was happening around the time of his death, probably who went and suicided him, had mysteriously disappeared. Epstein had been on suicide watch, taken off it, his cellmate conveniently removed, guards had fallen asleep, the cameras had malfunctioned, and with all the stars aligned, he was most likely taken out in a deep state operation. If we take this murder scenario seriously, which this book does, the next obvious question is, who pulled the strings? Let's look at the major contenders who have been outlined in this book and summarize the evidence and possible motives for them ordering the hit. My main suspect is Bill Clinton, or perhaps we should say, the Clinton crime family. When news of Epstein's death was first announced, fingers were immediately pointed at Hillary Clinton with the hashtag Clinton Body Count, trending on Twitter, and tweeted by President Trump. As we've seen in this series of books, the Clintons are certainly not averse to bumping off those who threaten to expose their sordid secret lives. A YouTube viewer kindly sent a list of the hashtag Clinton Body Count. Researching the Clintons over the years, reading books like Partners in Power, The Clintons, War on Women, and Terry Reid's Compromised, I was familiar with many of the names of the deceased. Number 1. James McDougal. Bill Clinton's convicted Whitewater partner. He was a key witness in Ken Starr's investigation. Supposedly he had a heart attack while in solitary confinement. Number 2. Mary Mahoney, former White House intern, was murdered in July 1997 at a Starbucks coffee shop in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. The murder happened after she had decided to go public with her story of sexual harassment in the White House. Number 3. Vince Foster. I urge you to go online and research about Vince Foster. His story will absolutely blow your mind. as a former White House counselor and colleague of Hillary Clinton's Little Rock Rose law firm. He died of a gunshot wound to the head. Although it was ruled a suicide, the body was obviously moved and the evidence doctored. He knew a lot about the dirty deeds done in Hillary's law firm. Number 4. Ron Brown, former Secretary of Commerce and DNC chairman. Reportedly, he died from the impact in a plane crash. A pathologist close to the investigation stated there was a hole in the top of Brown's skull resembling a gunshot wound. At the time of his death, Brown was being investigated and had spoken publicly of his willingness to cut a deal with the prosecutors. The rest of the people on the plane also died. A few days later, the air traffic controller committed suicide. And on it went. Number 5. C. Victor Reyser II, a major player in the Clinton fundraising machine, who died in a private plane crash in July 1992. Number 6. Paul Tully, Democratic National Committee political director, found dead in a hotel room in Little Rock, September 1992. Described by Clinton as a dear friend and trusted advisor. Number 7. Ed Willey, Clinton fundraiser, found dead in 1993 of a gunshot wound to the head, deep in the woods in Virginia. Ruled a suicide. Ed Willey died on the same day his wife, Kathleen Willey, claimed Bill Clinton had groped her in the Oval Office of the White House. Willey was involved in several Clinton fundraising events. Number 8. Jerry Parks, the former head of Bill Clinton's gubernatorial security team in Little Rock, gunned down in his car at a deserted intersection outside of Little Rock's park. His son said that his father was building a dossier on Clinton and that he had allegedly threatened to reveal this information. After he died, the files were mysteriously removed from his house. 9. James Bunch, who supposedly died from a gunshot suicide. It was reported that he had a black book of people which included elites who visited prostitutes in Texas and Arkansas. Again, the Epstein theme of blackmail and suicide. Number 10. James Wilson, who was found dead in May 1993 from apparent hanging suicide. He has ties to Whitewater. Number 11. Kathy Ferguson, the ex-wife of Arkansas trooper Danny Ferguson, was found dead in May 1994 in a living room with a gunshot to the head. Ruled a suicide, even though there were several packed suitcases as if she was planning to flee. Danny Ferguson was a co-defendant with Bill Clinton in the Paula Jones lawsuit. Kathy Ferguson was a possible corroborating witness with Paula Jones. Number 12. Bill Shelton, the Arkansas state trooper and fiancé of Kathy Ferguson. Critical of the suicide ruling of his fiancé. He was found dead in June 1994 with a gunshot wound, also ruled a suicide. Number 13. Gandhi Barr, attorney for Bill Clinton's friend Dan Lassiter. Gandhi Barr died by jumping out of a window of a tall building in January 1994. One of the biggest contributors to the Clinton campaigns, Lassiter was laundering money for the CIA-backed Arkansas cocaine operation. Barry Seal, the pilot who was killed, was dropping off money directly to Lassiter. As a money manager, he sold bonds, which were an integral part of the money laundering operation. Lassiter had easy access to Clinton through the back door of the state capitol building. Number 14. Florence Martin, a former accountant and subcontractor for CIA activity related to Barry Seal's Arkansas drug smuggling case. He died of 3 gunshot wounds. 15. Susan Coleman, who reportedly had an affair with Clinton when he was the Arkansas Attorney General. Pregnant at the time of her death, she died of a gunshot wound to the back of the head, which was ruled as a suicide. Number 16. Paula Grover, Clinton's speech interpreter for the deaf from 1978 until her death in December 1992. Died in a one-car accident. Number 17. Danny Cosolaro, investigative reporter, investigating MENA Airport and the Arkansas Development Finance Authority, who supposedly slit his wrists in the middle of the investigation. He was found dead in a bathtub in room 517 of the Sheraton Hotel in Martinsburg, West Virginia. His wrists had been slashed 10 to 12 times. The Arkansas Development Finance Authority was supposedly set up to bring jobs to Arkansas and boost the economy. But it was a money laundering scheme for cocaine proceeds. The amount of cash in the banks in Arkansas surged due to all the money laundering. Number 18. Paul Wiltshire, an attorney investigating corruption at MENA Airport with Casolaro in the 1980 October surprise, was found dead on the toilet on June the 22nd, 1993, in a Washington, D.C. apartment. He had delivered a report to Janet Reno 3 weeks before his death. Number 19. John Parnell Walker, a whitewater investigator for Resolution Trust, who jumped to his death from an apartment balcony in Darlington, Virginia, on August the 15th, 1993. He was also investigating the Madison Guarantee scandal. Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan Association was a savings and loan company in Little Rock, Arkansas. In 1989, after 10 years of operation, it was closed by federal regulators due to bank failure, leading to a $60 million loss for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The bank had been owned and managed by Jim McDougal, a friend of Bill and Hillary. Number 20. Barbara Wise, a Department of Commerce staffer who had worked closely with John Hwang, a senior DNC fundraiser who had solicited Indonesian gardeners and Buddhist nuns living under a vow of poverty. On November the 29th, 1996, her bruised and naked body was found locked in her office at the Department of Commerce. The cause of death is unknown. Number 21. Charles Meissner, the Assistant Secretary of Commerce who had given John Hwang special security clearance, died shortly thereafter in a small plane crash. Number 22. Dr. Stanley Hurd, the Chairman of the National Chiropractic Healthcare Advisory Committee, died with his attorney, Steve Dixon, in a small plane crash. Dr. Hurd, in addition to serving on Bill Clinton's advisory council, had personally treated Clinton's mother, stepfather, and brother. Number 23. Barry Seal, the drug-running CIA pilot. A federal judge had ordered Barry Seal to live in a halfway house with no bodyguards and no weapons, with the address publicly available. The Bush and Clinton crime families knew that the Colombians had a hit out on Seal. So, by forcing him to stay at a public address and removing his armed bodyguards, they enabled his assassination. Number 24. Johnny Lawhorn Jr., a mechanic who found a check made out to Bill Clinton in the trunk of a car left at his repair shop. Found dead after his car hit a utility pole. Number 25. Stanley Huggins, who investigated Madison Guarantee. His death was a purported suicide, and his report was never released. Number 26. Herschel Friday, an Arkansas bond lawyer and major donor to Clinton fundraisers, who died on March the 1st, 1994, when his plane exploded. Number 27. Seth Rich, a DC staffer, murdered and robbed. WikiLeaks claimed that he had info on the DNC email scandal. Number 28. Kevin Ives and Don Henry, known as the Boys on the Tracks. murdered after discovering CIA drug drops protected by Bill Clinton's Arkansas State Police. A controversial case, because the coroner, Malak, who was in Clinton's pocket, said that the boys had smoked cannabis and fallen asleep on the train tracks, next to each other, and been run over. One of the dads of the boys worked on the tracks, and he knew that was impossible. A later report claimed that they were slain before being put on the tracks. Many linked to the case died before being able to give testimony. All detailed in my book, Clinton, Bush, and CIA Conspiracies, from the boys on the tracks to Jeffrey Epstein. Here are some of the people who died who had information on the boys on the tracks case. Number 29, Keith Coney, whose motorcycle slammed into the back of a truck. Number 30, Keith McCaskill, who was stabbed 113 times. Number 31, Gregory Collins, who died from a gunshot wound. Number 32, Jeff Rhodes, who was shot and his mutilated body buried in a trash dump. Number 33, James Milan, who was decapitated, but the coroner ruled his death as natural causes. Number 34, Richard Winters, a suspect in the Ives Henry deaths, was killed in a set-up robbery in July 1989. A lot of the hashtag Clinton body count information came from former Clinton bodyguards, including Arkansas State Police troopers. Some are now dead. Number 35, Major William Barkley. Number 36, Captain Scott Reynolds. Number 37, Sergeant Brian Hanley. Number 38, Sergeant Tim Sable. Number 39, Major William Roberts. On February the 23rd, 1993, a Black Hawk helicopter crashed in Wiesbaden, Germany, killing five of Bill Clinton's bodyguards and associates. Numbers 40 to 43. Number 40, Colonel William Denzberger. Number 41, Colonel Robert Kelly. Number 42, Gary Rhodes. Number 43, Jarrett J. Robertson. Number 44, Stephen Wills. Number 45, Robert Williams. Number 46, Conway LeBlue. Number 47, Todd McKeon. I believe that one of the most recent in the hashtag Clinton body count is Jeffrey Epstein, and that the Clintons were big players in the murder conspiracy. But that does not preclude other heavyweights, including Prince Andrew, having input. Epstein clearly had something over Bill Clinton. In his own words, Epstein said that Clinton owed him favours. Given the nature of Epstein's operation and Clinton's intemperate sex drive, it's reasonable to assume that whatever it was involved sexual blackmail. With Epstein's arrest, all the dirt on Clinton was threatening to spill out in court. So the motive was clearly there. And again, with their connections, murdering someone in prison is something Bill and Hillary would have had the power and influence to pull off. The Clinton connection could also throw light on Epstein's mysterious 48-hour trip to Saudi Arabia on the eve of the presidential election in 2016. Had Epstein fled the country on the expectation that Hillary would win? Did he have reason to believe that, with Hillary in power, he would have to be eliminated because of the dirt he had on her husband? Was his intention to stay permanently outside of the US? And did he return 48 hours later, when he knew Trump was in office and thus it was safe or safer to return? Then there is Prince Andrew and the UK's royal family. That Epstein had dirt on Andrew is unequivocal. There is enough evidence exposing Andrew in compromising situations involving Epstein and girls. Given that these alleged crimes, Andrew denies everything, occurred on so many occasions within multiple Epstein properties, it is almost ludicrous to think that Epstein didn't have a video and photographic evidence. And what other nefarious secrets could Epstein have spilled on Andrew? It's almost certain that Andrew's documented alleged crimes are just the tip of the iceberg. And what about the other royals? We know that Epstein and Maxwell were also close to Andrew's ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, and that Epstein had loaned Fergie £15,000, according to mainstream media, but more likely a multiple of £15,000, as that amount would have been meaningless to Fergie, probably to pay off debts. We know from Maria Farmer's testimony that Epstein, and especially Maxwell, had intimate chats with Andrew and Fergie in which many secrets might have been divulged, like their shared hatred and mockery of Diana. Could one of these secrets have been information on Diana's death? Information that could not be allowed to become public? Unless we forget the huge power and influence of the royal family, we need just to remember how ABC News anchor Amy Robach was secretly filmed admitting that her network had been forced to pull her 2015 interview with Virginia Giuffre, exposing Andrew, due to threats from Buckingham Palace. If the royals could keep such a massive story quiet for several years, could they have the power to assassinate Epstein inside a New York prison cell, perhaps via MI6, and with the collusion of US intelligence agencies? I think it's not all that unreasonable to suggest that this is a possibility. Talking of intelligence agencies, let's not forget the Mossad. Throughout this audiobook, we've looked at Epstein's links to Israeli intelligence, which go back as far as the 1980s, when Robert Maxwell probably introduced him into the fold via his links to Wexner and the Mega Group. Epstein was clearly an agent of an international Israeli intelligence and crime syndicate involved in drug and weapons smuggling, child trafficking, and money laundering enterprises. His main role throughout the 90s and 2000s, it appears, was sexual blackmail of prominent political figures to further the aims of this spiderweb of intrigue. With his dirty laundry about to be aired in court, the threat of these secrets, especially the use of paedophilia for political blackmail purposes, could have been utterly disastrous for Israel's reputation. There would have been only one option left in such a situation. Get rid of Epstein. Did the Mossad have the power and capability to pull off hits like this in secure locations on foreign soil? The question is almost laughable. There are so many historical examples of them doing exactly this. We also have the almost exact historical template for the Epstein hit in the case of Robert Maxwell, the man who was at the forefront of an international Mossad-linked crime operation who then started to become a liability. He was about to face a court trial and thus might spill the beans. Regardless of his renown, wealth and position, I believe that the man was quickly and quietly taken out by a Mossad hit team, and the murder presented, credibly, as a suicide. The Clintons, the royals and Israeli intelligence all had the motives and the power to have Epstein suicided. However, despite all of this, there remains one intriguing possibility that we've not yet covered. The chance that Epstein didn't die at all in that prison cell. That his death was faked, and he was smuggled away, and that he is still at large today. It sounds incredible, but it might not be as far-fetched as it seems. Firstly, presuming Epstein knew about his imminent escape, it would explain the last-minute change to his will, as he would have known he was about to officially die. It would have accounted for his apparent mental deterioration, as Epstein would have been play-acting at being suicidal in preparation for the fake death. It would also explain the apparent security anomalies, as, clearly, whoever bust him from jail would have to have fixed the suicide with the collusion of the prison authorities. It would also explain that mysterious visit to Epstein's Manhattan mansion the day after his death. As we have already seen, Epstein's long-term accountant, Richard Kahn, was seen sneaking into the 71st Street townhouse on the day after Epstein's death and was photographed emerging with a shopping bag full of items about 45 minutes later. If this was sensitive material that the FBI wanted to get their hands on, why hadn't someone removed it earlier? The house had already been swept with a fine-tooth comb for incriminating evidence. It would make more sense that the bag contained vital items required for Epstein's self-passage away from New York and onto a new life. Items like a passport and other important documents, as well as cash or diamonds. We know there were lots of these floating around the mansion. We know the 71st Street house was riddled with secret doors and hidden rooms and passages. No doubt these critical possessions had been stashed away somewhere even the FBI had been unable to find, waiting for the moment when Kahn or another of Epstein's cronies would come to smuggle them out. Epstein researcher Frederick Ponton believes that towards the end, Epstein was becoming increasingly paranoid for his safety and was planning on retiring somewhere outside the US to enjoy a life of relative peace. Ponton believes Epstein had decided upon Paris, a place that he loved, to retire. So perhaps Epstein had been preparing for such a sudden and secretive move for some time, even before his arrest. In such a case, everything would have been lined up in advance for just such a hasty and secretive departure, as his fake death would necessitate. Another anomaly that this theory would clear up is the fact that Epstein's estate continued transferring money to other Epstein accounts after his death. A New York Times article from February 2021 revealed that Epstein's estate had transferred no less than $15.5 million to an organization called Southern Country International in December 2019, 4 months after his death. Southern Country was a bank operating out of the US Virgin Islands that Epstein had set up in 2014. However, despite some generous tax breaks from the US Virgin Islands authorities, the bank had done no business from that time until Epstein's death. At the time of his death, according to the Times article, the bank had assets of $693,157. Then in December 2019, two checks totaling $15.5 million were paid in by Epstein's estate. Southern Country sent back $2.6 million, leaving the total it received at $12.9 million. But by the end of the year, Southern Country's funds amounted to just $497,759, indicating that the bulk of the money had been transferred elsewhere. None of the transfer documents indicated the reason for these movements. And, when pressed for information on the payments by the US Virgin Islands authorities, a lawyer for Epstein's estate said merely that some of the transfers were made in error. What could explain these mysterious payments to Epstein's own private bank better than that the proceeds were going to Epstein himself, wherever he had set up his new secret life? Then there were the anomalies with the autopsy. At the request of Epstein's attorneys, the autopsy was observed by the private pathologist, Dr. Michael Baden. Why did the controversial pathologist, who had been an expert witness in the O.J. Simpson trial and the head of the pathology panel on the investigation into the JFK assassination, need to be involved in the study of Epstein's body? Why was the evidence of several broken bones, including the hyoid bone, discounted in ascribing the death as suicide? And why did the medical examiner's office stall on releasing the autopsy report, which should by law have been sent to Epstein's family as soon as the death certificate was released, but which was actually delayed for 2 weeks after the cause of death was first announced? All of these questions could point to some kind of tampering with the corpse, or even the use of a body double. Body doubles might sound like the stuff of Hollywood movies, but they are not as far-fetched as they appear. Prominent politicians and high-profile figures around the world have been using body doubles for centuries, and the CIA has a long history of utilizing body doubles in its espionage work. There is a credible theory that the CIA switched a body double for JFK's corpse after the president's assassination to make the wounds fit more accurately with the official narrative. Is it a coincidence, then, that the head of the investigation into JFK's murder was also present at Epstein's autopsy? A similar mystery surrounds the initial findings of Epstein's body. Why did guards remove the corpse from Epstein's cell, thus violating Bureau of Prisons protocols, which state that suicide scenes should be treated with the same level of protection as any crime scene in which a death has occurred? Why did the guards not take any photographs of Epstein's body as it was found? And why did they put out an emergency call for Epstein to be taken to hospital rather than a death report, thus ensuring that few or no press would be waiting outside to photograph the corpse? The theory that Epstein didn't die was resurrected in 2021 by pro-Trump attorney Lynn Wood, who claimed he knew of three high-level, credible sources who had all told him Epstein was alive and well. Although he wouldn't name his sources or give any evidence for the claim, Wood did make a very sound argument for the case that Epstein was still alive. Wood said that someone like Epstein, who was up to his neck in espionage and organized crime and sexual blackmail operations, would have been acutely aware of the possibility of being suicided. Bearing this in mind, it is almost certain that he would have set up a so-called dead man switch, which would effectively make public all the dirt he had on everyone, or selected targets, in the event of his death. As we have heard from Ponton, Epstein was growing increasingly worried about being murdered in the last years of his life and was making plans to extricate himself from the web he had built. It hardly seems plausible, given his paranoia and planning, that Epstein wouldn't have set up a dead man switch to mitigate the possibility of being taken out. It's also implausible that, given Epstein's sexual blackmail operation, organizations like the CIA and the Mossad wouldn't have expected Epstein to have such an insurance policy. The risk to either agency's reputation of this switch being activated would have been too great. Far safer to arrange a fake death and let Epstein live out the rest of his life in secrecy and peace. The idea that Epstein might still be alive is both intriguing and extremely unsettling. Where is he living? What is he doing? Is his perverse sexual appetite undiminished? And is he still being served up a string of underage girls each day? Which of his close associates knows the answers to all these questions? Perhaps we will never know whether Epstein died, or how he died. In that New York prison cell, on August the 10th, 2019. But one thing is certain. The secrets haven't stopped emerging, and they will continue to do so for months, perhaps years into the future. The Epstein story is far from over. Watch out for Who Killed Epstein Part 2, which will incorporate the developments since the publication of this book, including a greater focus on Ghislaine Maxwell.